Things have a symmetry which wasn't realized for 40 years, and then this symmetry was realized, and then it took another few years for that symmetry to be interpreted as implying that space and time are part of a single entity called space-time, which has this symmetry interchanging space with time. And you may be interested that right now similar explorations are going on in quantum field theory, that where again we know the right theory. We know what QCD is, for example. It's a complete and consistent theory of strong interactions. But it has some remarkable hidden symmetries which people are trying to understand. And they're actually doing very much what people did 100 years ago, which is to try to rewrite the equations in a different form and hopefully see what these symmetries actually are. So this is a tried and tested method of doing theoretical physics to work with laws which you know are correct and consistent, but which you don't fully understand what they mean. It's not the only way to do physics, but it's one way to do physics. Okay, so just to summarize so far, to rewrite Maxwell's equations in such a way as the symmetry was manifest, I introduced a few extra quantities. One is eta, which is this matrix, just like the Kronecker delta matrix, but with a funny minus one for time. And in relativity, that's the only difference between space and time, that minus one is responsible for causality and all kinds of other deep properties of the world. They're simply a result of a minus sign there. We also introduced epsilon, totally anti-symmetric tensor. With upstairs indices, it is plus one if those indices are an even permutation. And by the way, there's an easy way to check if something is an even permutation or not. Say I just write down 0, 2, 3, 1, and I want to know, is that an even or odd permutation of 0, 1, 2, 3? So write 0, 1, 2, 3 next to it, and connect the numbers like that. Okay, and the number of crossings of those lines, if it's even, it's an even permutation. If it's odd, it's an odd permutation. Okay? We introduced the Kronecker delta. It's just the standard Kronecker delta. That's 1 if alpha equals, if the two indices are equal, 0 otherwise. And then I showed you that you can rewrite the Maxwell's equations instead of being four equations, you write them as two equations. These two equations. And now the basic claim is these equations are obviously invariant under this transformation, Lorentz transformation. Now, why is that obvious? Well, the basic statement is if I want to write down some equations which are invariant under a linear transformation like this, I just write them tensorially. Okay? Any equation written in terms of tensors, i.e. quantities with upstairs and downstairs indices, okay, where the indices balance on the left and right, and you're allowed to sum over indices to sort of remove them on the left or the right, any equation written tensorially is automatically invariant. Okay? So we'll just see that in a second. But I'll remind you, Lorentz transformations, by definition, something with an upstairs index transforms with a lambda. Something with a, and the lambdas were defined to leave eta invariant. Okay, so eta, we have eta alpha beta equals lambda equals eta mu nu lambda mu alpha eta nu beta. Okay, so the transformation of eta just gives you back eta. Okay, so eta is an invariant tensor under Lorentz transformations. So something with an upstairs index goes with lambda, so a downstairs index goes with lambda twiddle, and lambda twiddle is the inverse of lambda. So the whole way you construct it is to ensure that if I've got one index up and one index down, The down one will transform under lambda. The up will transform under lambda twiddle. But by definition, lambda twiddle is the inverse of lambda. And so when you transform this equation, these contracted indices don't transform. Okay, the transformation cancels. So we can sort of do that explicitly. So the claim is that if Maxwell's equations are true in one Lorentz frame, they will be true in any Lorentz frame. Okay, so let's prove that. Let's calculate Maxwell's equations in the primed frame, mu naught j beta prime. And to do that, we just have to transform everything. Okay, so the derivative transformed is a lower index. So this is d gamma f mu nu lambda twiddle gamma, right? So the lower index transforms with lambda twiddle. The upper indices transform with lambda. So alpha. Sorry, I want a beta over there. I want an alpha beta there. So I want alpha mu lambda beta nu. Okay, so these matrices are transforming the two upper indices there and changing them into alpha and beta. So that's the first term. And then the second term is mu naught j lambda beta nu j nu. But then the point is that lambda twiddle lambda is delta. So this object here is just delta gamma mu. And so we have d. And now, because it's delta gamma mu, I can convert this index to mu. So this is d mu f mu nu lambda nu beta. But you see, in this term, I also have a lambda nu beta. So let's put those two terms together. Nu lambda beta nu. Okay, but the right-hand side is zero because that was our assumption. So if Maxwell's equations are true in one frame, the unprimed frame, then they're true in any frame. And it's easy to convince yourself that provided I wrote down any law at all, which is a tensor law, which is expressed in this way, it would be a Lorentz invariant. Yeah. Oh, the Poincaré group. Okay. So the Poincaré group is a larger group of transformations. The Lorentz group, and let me give you a little bit of sort of group theory. When you have an equation like this, this is what's called a matrix group. Okay, so it's a group of matrices. You can check that for something to be a group, what it requires is there are several things required, one of which is that if you multiply two group elements, you get another group element. So you can kind of check that if I had a lambda and another lambda, and I multiply the two of them together, and each one of them satisfies this equation, then the product will also. You can also check every group element has an inverse. That's one of the properties of a group. And that's the inverse. So this is a matrix group, and the actual group it is SO3-1. Okay, SO3 means orthogonal matrices. Orthogonal matrices are defined so that O transpose O is 1. This would be an orthogonal group, say in three dimensions, the rotations. The S here means that the determinant is plus 1. Okay, so SO3-1 is the proper. I already showed you the determinant is either plus 1 or minus 1. The plus 1 part of it is SO3-1. Okay? So it's a continuous group. And the notation here, 3, 1, means that instead of using the Kronecker delta here, you see, if this was a Kronecker delta, it would have been SO4. It would have been a rotation group in four dimensions. But the SO3-1 means that you have 3 positive. So they're the 3 plus 1s in the eta and a minus 1. Okay, that's what the 3-1 indicates. So if I wrote down SO2-2, that would be the group where this matrix was plus 1, was minus 1, minus 1, plus 1, plus 1. Okay, that would be SO22. So that's a little bit of notation. The Poincaré group is what you get when you combine this with translations. Okay, so the Lorentz group you can think of as the group of transformations like this. So that's Lorentz, where this guy is a SO31 matrix. Okay, and the Poincaré is where you have Lorentz. Well, let's write down translations. What is a translation? Translation is x prime mu is x mu plus c mu, some constant four vector. Okay, and the laws of physics are invariant under translations too. I mean, the laws of physics over here are just the same as they are over there. That's actually a consequence of cosmology. Okay, we live in a translation invariant universe, approximately. It's only approximately translation invariant. But the translations plus Lorentz, you see, actually, any equations I write down which are only involve, which do not explicitly involve x, okay, are guaranteed to be translation invariant. So because the d by dx prime mu under translations, well, this is just dx dx prime, which is delta, right? So this, of course, means that x mu is x prime mu minus c mu. And if I want to calculate d by dx prime mu, I take dx alpha dx prime mu, d by dx alpha, right? But differentiating x alpha by x mu prime, I'm going to, so dx alpha by dx mu prime is just delta alpha mu. Because if you differentiate, you know, x by y, you get nothing. X by z, you get nothing. X by t, you get nothing. But differentiation of x by x, you get 1. Okay, so this is equal to d by dx alpha. So you see, Maxwell's equations don't involve x at all. They involve d by dx. But d by dx is invariant under translations. And so Maxwell's equations are invariant under both Lorentz and translations. And the combination of these two things is called a Poincaré group. Okay. It's kind of interesting to count the number of dimensions you have in a group. How many different parameters, independent parameters, are there in this group? Okay. Well, translations is easy because there are four parameters. I can translate x, y, z, or t by independent amounts. So there are four parameters here. And in the Lorentz group, does anyone know how many parameters in the Lorentz group?
Six.
Six. Yeah. It's rotations. And three rotations and three boosts. I can rotate around the x, y, or z axis, and then I can boost in the x, y, or z directions by an arbitrary parameter, and every Lorentz transformation can be composed out of those operations. So this is 10-dimensional. Continuous group. Actually, you've done group theory, so you should know all this. Okay, so that was a bit of a tangent, but that's fine. And let me also say, please, you know, do interrupt, because I get really bored if I'm just talking to myself. Okay, so please stop me and complain, or interrupt, or introduce other points. It's all fine. Okay, so the rule for building. This is so obvious that I'm not sure I should even write it down, but the rule for building Lorentz invariant theories is that you should write the equations tensorially. Okay, so if you can write your equations in your theory tensorially, then you know it's Lorentz invariant. Okay, so it's very, very simple rule. So we started with the symmetry of the Maxwell equations, but the symmetry is quite, we then tried to interpret it in terms of a transformation of x, and of course d by dx. So x has an upstairs index, it transforms with lambda, and d by dx has a downstairs index. So it transforms as lambda twiddle, the inverse of lambda. And so that suggests we think about, clearly these transformations are mixing space and time. Remember, x alpha is ct and x, so the components have the same dimensions. And these transformations are mixing up space and time, so now we look in space-time. And consider things like the trajectory of a particle. Okay, so this is the particle world line. The different choices of coordinates here correspond to different what is called coordinate frames. And within some of those coordinate frames, the particle will be stationary. Well, within a particular frame, it will be stationary. Okay, and in other frames, it won't. And basically, these laws tell you how to go from one frame to another. A very useful fact is that if I take two points in space-time, x mu and y mu, okay, so they're just a set of four numbers telling you ct, x, y, and z. So if we take these two points in space-time, then the invariant distance from x to y is eta alpha beta x alpha minus y alpha x beta minus y beta. Okay, so that's the Lorentz invariant distance. There are no indices here. I've contracted all the indices. So I'm guaranteed that the lambdas and the lambda twiddles will cancel. So you know that this quantity is invariant under Lorentz transformations. So in particular, if one of the particles is at zero, okay, so if you're measuring, if you put one of your points at the origin of that set of space-time coordinates, then eta alpha beta, x alpha x beta, is just minus c squared t squared plus x squared. And that's going to be equal to the same quantity in primed coordinates. So that's c squared t prime squared plus x prime squared. So mathematically, you can see that this is invariant. Okay, this Lorentz invariant, the Lorentz version of the distance or length of a vector. Physically, can you tell me what this represents? What is this? If I write this equation down, let's imagine that I set it equal to zero. What does this represent physically? What is that equation? What does it represent? Pardon?
It's the world line of the light ray.
It's not a world line because it's an equation of four variables. Right? So I'm going to write this out. It's you're right, but it's not a line. It's this. So equation in four dimensions. One equation gives you a three-dimensional surface. Right? There's a three-dimensional set of points which will satisfy this equation. Is a light cone. Okay? Or even more physically, what it represents is a spherical light wave. Okay? If I have a light bulb and it goes on and off very quickly, the light wave will travel out. And this is telling me that the radius squared is c squared t squared. So it's a spherical light wave. And in space-time, as you said, it's a light cone. So this, I've started it at the origin. Could have started it anywhere. But basically, it looks like this and like that, right? If my going into the board is y, and this circle here, I've drawn it as a circle, but that's because I can only draw two dimensions of space. It should really be a sphere, right? That x squared plus y squared plus z squared is c squared t squared, so this radius here is ct. And so the line you're making is 45 degrees with respect to the axis. Okay, so that's a light cone. Okay, so light cone is something very physical. It just means that if at that moment of space-time I emit a spherical shell of light, the locus of that shell will be the light cone. Okay. And so then we discussed time dilation and Lorentz contraction from this point of view. And essentially, once you get the picture that all I'm doing is thinking about space-time and then throwing down a set of coordinates on it, the original coordinates, and then my Lorentz transformed coordinates, it's manifestly clear this is going to work. Okay? Okay, so I had my x and ct, then the Lorentz transformed coordinates are like this, and in the new coordinates, what is lines of constant ct prime are like this. You see that, so the axes are not at right angles. And so if you have graph paper in your primed coordinates, the axes have to go like this, and likewise like that. Okay. So these are lines of constant x prime, and these are lines of constant ct prime. And so if I give you some event in the world, okay, here, and you can tell what its x coordinates are, that's a world event, okay, space-time event. It has some coordinates x and some time t. Then from reading off these axes and the lines of coordinates, you can tell me what x prime and ct prime it's at. Okay, so now let us discuss particles. So what is a particle? We've already discussed that. It's just a world line in space-time. And so this particle is located at some x, but moves forwards in time. And its world line is represented by a parameterized curve. Okay? So lambda is a parameter. Okay, just a dimensionless number. And it can go from minus infinity to plus infinity. And for each value of lambda, the four space-time coordinates take a particular value. Then we say that the curve is time-like if eta mu nu dx mu d lambda dx mu d lambda is positive, is negative, okay? And that should be clear, because basically it means that if I take two points near each other on the curve and ask what is the Lorentz invariant distance between those two points, it's just eta mu nu dx mu dx nu. Okay, if dx mu is this this little displacement along the curve. And so the Lorentz invariant distance along the curve is that quantity. If it's positive, then introducing two d lambdas on the bottom is not going to make any difference. And so, or negative. And so if this quantity is negative, it's time-like. If it's equal to zero, it's null. And it's positive, it's space-like. Okay, and then, as we shall see, physical massive particles must follow time-like curves. And this number is always negative. Essentially, the reason is that if you want to take a physical particle and accelerate it up to the speed of light, you can try. But as you do that, its mass grows, and the energy required diverges as you push it up to the speed of light. And so you without infinite source of energy, you can't go faster than the speed of light. And unfortunately, we don't know of any particles that move faster than the speed of light. They may exist. They're called tachyons. If they did exist, they would be extremely useful, okay? Because then you could use them to send messages faster than light. Yep.
Is it a physical reason that curve must be either time-like, null, or space-like?
No. I see. No. If I just draw a general curve, it can change.
Yeah, I mean, but it can't represent anything physical.
No. So the statement is that, so obviously I can just draw any curve.
Yeah.
Okay. And this will go from being time-like to space-like to time-like and null and so on. But the statement is that if I have a particle, and we'll see this in a moment, it's going time-like. Let's say it's at rest. It's time-like. And now I try to accelerate it. So the curve would be going vertical. Now I accelerate it. And I try to get to 45 degrees. 45 degrees, it's going null. As you accelerate it faster and faster, its mass grows. And the acceleration, the force required to accelerate it diverges. So you cannot get it faster than the speed of light. Okay, that's what the relativistic laws of mechanics say.
So would that mean that a tachyon can't be slowed down?
Exactly. The tachyon is condemned to travel faster than light, always. And photon is also condemned to travel at the speed of light, always. And when you think about this, it's very peculiar. Okay. The photon actually doesn't have any sense of time at all. There's no notion of time for a photon. Whereas a particle, you can always think of it as carrying its clock with it. And a particle has a notion of time. Okay. So massive particles must follow time-like curves. I'm just going to assert that at this point. We'll see why in a moment. And so in this case, it makes sense to parameterize the curve, using the proper time Okay, so the way I describe this, that lambda could be anything, and there are any number of parameterizations that will give you the same curve, right? I could pick lambda to be any function, some lambda prime, to any function of lambda at all, provided it's monotonic. Okay, so lambda goes from minus infinity to infinity. Pick some other function of lambda that also goes to minus infinity, from minus infinity to plus infinity, and always increases. That's a perfectly good parameterization of the line. Okay, but there is a special parameterization for a time-like curve, which is to say, let us literally calculate between any two points on the curve what is the Lorentz invariant separation, and that's the parameter. Okay, so we define d tau squared, that's the proper time, c dt squared minus dx squared. So you think of two points on the curve separated by dt and dx, and just construct this Lorentz invariant distance between them. And so I can take the square root of that. Dt is equal to square root of c of, actually, dt is the square root of, I'll take the cdt out the front, square root of 1 minus v squared over c squared, where v is dx dt. Okay, so v is the actual velocity in these coordinates, x and t. Yep. Yeah, it's a good point. I don't mind introducing a C there. I may get rid of it later. Yeah. In fact, it's probably good to put the C there, because if we want to interpret tor as the time in the Lorentz frame where the particle is stationary, okay, so I can always do a boost to a frame where the particle is, where basically this is the t prime axis, right? If I take this curve, it's going at some angle, but if I choose that to be the t prime axis, then obviously it's static in the x prime coordinates. It's not moving anywhere in x prime. And so we can go to a Lorentz frame in which the dx is 0 along the curve. And then d tau is just dt. So if I write it this way, then what this tau means physically, it's the time measured by a clock on the particle, right? By a clock which is moving with the particle. So it's the time measured in the frame in which the particle is at rest. So that's a good parameterization, and you could just integrate that. So you can say tor is equal to integral dt square root 1 minus v squared to c squared. Oh, sure. Do you want me to write this out again? Or?
No.
You've got that. Okay. So tor is equal to integral dt square root 1 minus v squared over c squared. Okay, so I think about this curve. I work out what is x of t. That tells me the curve. I work out dx dt, and I construct this quantity, and that will give me tau, the parameter along the curve. So that number tau is the number measured by a clock carried along with the particle. Which one?
The eta dx mu dy.
This one? No. That's that is just a number, and in fact we will find out that in this parameterization it's minus one.
Okay.
So the slope, to get the slope, literally think of this as a curve in the xt plane. Okay? So if I want the slope here, what is v? V is dx dt. Okay, that's the velocity. So I think of this as the y-axis, and that as the x-axis, and then the slope is dx dt. So v can change. The velocity of the particle can change as it moves along. If you push it, the velocity will change. But it'll turn out that this quantity, actually it's clear from here. You see, if I parameterize the curve this way, if that's my parameter, then by definition, eta mu nu, dx mu d tau, dx mu d tau is equal to minus 1. Okay, you can see that from here. Take this equation, divide by d tau. Now you've... okay, wait a second. You've messed me up with my C. I'm going to take that C out. Sorry. because I want tau to be... okay, let me see. Otherwise, I'm... I want tau to have units of velocity. Okay, so tau is C times the time measured in the particle stress frame. So let's take that out. The reason I want that is then I get a very nice equation here, because x mu has dimensions of length, tau has dimensions of length, and this is minus 1. So let's see, is this clear from here? So I just take this equation, divide by d tau squared, and I get c squared dt d tau squared minus dx squared dx d tau squared equals 1. And so I'll put a minus sign here, plus sign there, minus there. And this quantity here is just eta mu nu dx mu d tau dx mu d tau. Sorry, I'm in your way. Yeah.
So I have a question.
Sure. Do you mean the sign of tau?
Yes.
Yes, so I picked a plus when I wrote the square root.
Okay.
So I picked a plus here. And that means that I'm choosing tau to increase as I run up the curve.
But if you have something that is like light-like or space-like?
I'm not going to deal with that yet. Okay. If the curve is time-like, none of this works. Is null. None of this works. I cannot pick the time along the curve. I cannot pick, you know, if I define tau this way and the curve is null, d tau is zero. So it doesn't parameterize the curve. It's just not increasing at all. So it's not a useful parameter if the curve is null. Yeah.
So the proper time is a length.
Proper time is a length.
Okay.
That's what happens with relativity. Length and time get mixed up.
So why is the minus sign in front of the x and not the t this time?
Here?
Yes.
No, that was the definition of proper time.
Oh.
Okay, because I wanted to have the same sign as the time component.
Okay.
But you notice when I divided by d tau squared, I then multiplied it with a minus sign. In order to make it equal to this quantity. And so that's why we got the minus 1 on that side. Okay, so the conclusion is that massive particles can be parameterized, their curves can be parameterized by the proper time along the curve, and we define this quantity, okay, and this is a four velocity. And notice it's dimensionless. Okay? So I apologize for this, but doesn't have dimensions of space over time. It has dimensions of nothing. And that's because tau has dimensions of length. Okay? And so eta mu nu is minus 1. So the four velocity of a particle has square minus 1. Lorentz invariant square minus 1. And now we define a four momentum. And this will have dimensions of momentum. And that will define to be the rest mass of a particle. Times the speed of light. And so now I have something with dimensions of momentum multiplied by u mu. And you'll notice that the square of them, so it's just a constant times the four velocity. Okay? And the square of the four momentum, which is eta mu nu p mu p nu, which is minus p naught squared plus p squared, is equal to, so I just square that and use that u squared is minus 1, and so this is equal to m naught squared c squared, and so we infer that p naught is the square root of m naught squared c squared plus p squared. That naught should have an upper index. And notice I picked the plus sign for the square root because I can see from here that the upper index, p naught with a raised index is u naught with a raised index, and u naught is dx dt d tau, and we pick tau precisely to go in the positive direction along the curve. So this is for future pointing. For velocity. Yeah?
There's a minus sign on the top of the right mass.
Oh, thank you. No, I just squared this, and u squared is minus 1. This is a momentum. MC is a momentum. So maybe you're thinking p naught is the energy?
Yeah,
no, it isn't. No, it isn't. It's the four momentum. Just be careful that when I make a four vector, its components must have the same dimension. Otherwise, it makes no sense. So the p naught is a momentum, not an energy.
P naught
is p naught is the zero component of this four momentum. Okay, it's the zero component of the four momentum. Yeah.
So I think we're just used to
the
momentum put C equals 1 and forget about everything.
Yeah, actually, if you do that, you can get yourself confused. I guess Nemo was doing dimensional analysis with you in his week.
Yeah.
Actually, in the way he does it, I believe if he kept C, it would be he wouldn't have to make some of the assumptions he had to make. C is useful. So I prefer to keep C. If you're doing dimensional, I mean, it's important to know that length and time are different quantities. Yeah?
So I was going to say, is there a zero component of four momentum? Is there an interpretation of P naught?
Sorry?
Is there an interpretation of P naught?
Yeah, it's a zero component of the four momentum. we'll see what it is in a second, okay? Don't be too anxious about this. You see, but there's actually a very important here, I should stress. The way Lorentz transformations are a symmetry, okay? By definition, a symmetry is a sort of dimensionless thing. I mean, when I write SO31, these are matrices which are dimensionless. Okay, there's no scale in them. Just saying that I do this operation with a sort of angle, okay, dimensionless number, the laws of physics don't change. And what you will sometimes read about are papers that talk about the variable speed of light. I don't know if anyone's ever heard about this, a book called Faster Than the Speed of Light. This is actually a misunderstanding of what Lorentz invariance is. Okay? Lorentz invariance is a dimensionless symmetry. It's not specified by the speed of light. If I made the speed of light 10 or 100 or 1,000, wouldn't make any difference. Either the laws have this invariance or they don't. Okay? And so what that author discovered when trying to work out this theory with a variable speed of light is, of course, that it wasn't Lorentz invariant. Okay? There was no way to... The theory is only Lorentz invariant if C is constant. And the first thing that went out of the window is Lorentz invariant in that theory. And then the issue... Then when that's gone, you're kind of inconsistent with all known physics from step one. And then you're in the position of trying to rescue this disaster from the beginning. And so this is a very important point. The notion of symmetry, you know, sometimes people say the speed of light is a constant. That's the law of relativity. That's not the law of relativity. The law of relativity is that the laws of nature are invariant under a symmetry. Okay? It doesn't matter what the speed of light is. It's just a constant. Okay. Okay, so now let us go back and try. So we will begin to interpret these things. Notice that I told you that the velocity is dx dt. Okay? That's just the completely naive notion of velocity. It's just the distance you move divided by the time. That's the velocity of a particle. And we can write this as p over p naught. Because, you see, this is equal to m naught c dt d tau dx d tau. And the velocity is dx dt, so I just have to divide the space component by the time component, and the d taus will cancel, and I'll get dx dt. Okay, so the velocity is p over p naught. But I know that, this is actually over c. Yeah, v is dx dt. There was a c in here, right? Because x naught is ct. X naught is the length also. Okay, so the velocity is dx dt, p over p naught. Do I want a c up there? C. Okay, I just take this formula. This one is p, that's p naught. Divide p by p naught, I get dx dt. And multiply it by c to get rid of the factor of c. And so v over c is equal to p over, now I can use this formula for p naught, square root of m naught squared c squared plus p squared. Sorry, which c?
The c you just put in for p.
This one?
Higher up. You just added a c in.
Did I?
Yeah, didn't you?
No. No, I didn't add a c in anywhere. Remember x naught, what is x naught? You see, u mu is dx mu dt. Uh-huh. What is x mu? X mu is ct x. A four vector has to have the same dimension, so you can't put a t in there. You have to have a ct. Okay? That's why when I draw space-time diagrams, it's always length versus length, ct versus x. Okay. So, all right, so that's the formula for the velocity of the particle. Now you immediately see this has to be less than that v mod v over c is less than 1, right? Because the numerator, if I square this, I'm going to get p squared over this quantity. And as long as m naught squared is positive, the velocity is less than the speed of light. Furthermore, we see the only way to get to the speed of light is to make the momentum go to infinity. Right? So equality. Yeah. So V mod V going to C requires mod P going to infinity. Now, momentum going to infinity, what does that mean? That means infinite force. Okay? Because by definition, the force acting on a particle is the rate of change of the momentum. Okay, with respect to ordinary time. Okay, that's the definition of a force. And if you want to make the momentum go to infinity, you better apply an infinite force. You could, but then the energy input would be infinite. So, in fact, that was the problem you solved yesterday. Yesterday you worked out the work done. You worked out the work was equal to force times velocity, right? And you showed that that was equal to d by dt of gamma m naught c squared. And so that showed you that the work you did, this is the time derivative of the work, d by dt of the work. And so that showed you that when you do some work on the particle by pushing it in the direction that it's moving already, okay, so if you push a particle to accelerate it, you're doing work on it, and you showed yesterday that was the rate of change of gamma m naught c squared, and so that already tells you that this must be the energy of the particle. So you're having to put in infinite energy of the particle. The gamma here is this 1 over root 1 minus v squared. Okay, so now if I go back to this equation, then it's just a little bit of algebra to see that p is equal to gamma m naught v, where gamma equals 1 over root 1 minus v squared over c squared. Okay, so to get this equation, I just square that one. V squared over c squared is p squared over that. Solve for p squared, and I'll get this formula.
Why are we in that problem? Why are we taking the definitions of force and work with respect to coordinate time rather than proper time?
Yeah, it's a good question. The answer will be that force, like everything else, is a component of a four vector, okay? Not sure if I can give a very good answer. We will write down a Lorentz invariant force law. Okay, the way to do physics properly, start with a Lorentz invariant equation, and then figure out what it means in a specific set of coordinates. Okay? When we do that, we will find that the analog of force is this quantity. Okay, we'll find that this is the correct equation. Okay, we'll do that in due course. That doesn't directly answer you, but I hope it shows you the principles you proceed. You start with a Lorentz invariant equation. You want to define force. What do you even mean by force? Okay? Start with a Lorentz invariant equation of motion where there's something playing the role of force, and then figure out what that force is. We'll do an example in a moment. But this is very important to remember that's the definition of force. Much like the definition of velocity doesn't involve anything Lorentz invariant, right? velocity is a completely coordinate-dependent quantity. And so is force. Okay, where are we? So we've inferred this equation, and you can see just by comparing this to that, that gamma is equal to this, which is equal to square root of 1 plus p squared over m naught squared c squared. And so it follows that p naught is equal to gamma m naught c. So the question is, what is p naught? Okay, it's plausible that p is the momentum. Okay, p equals momentum. But what is this p naught? Okay, and the people have already said is it the energy? It has the wrong units for energy. Okay, but as it will turn out, p naught c is the energy. And the exercise you did yesterday is one sort of derivation of that. But what I'm going to do now is show you Einstein's derivation of the fact that that p naught c is the energy. Okay, so this is the very famous formula, E equals mc squared, and that m there is really gamma m naught. Okay, so I want to show you Einstein's argument. And this really shows you how the origin of all of this is just Maxwell's equations. Okay, so the one piece of truth Einstein had to rest on is Maxwell's equation. Everything followed from that. And I know our Scottish student will be happy to know that. Okay, so Einstein was nothing compared to Maxwell. Okay. All credit to the Scots. And as I've shown you, Einstein's paper is like 3 pages, right, for the most important formula of the 20th century. The origin of nuclear energy, of atomic bombs. It's a bad thing, but still, that's where it led to. This formula E equals mc squared is, probably the classic formula of the 20th century. And the paper's 3 pages, and it all comes from Maxwell's equations. Okay, so how did Einstein get to this result? And I do encourage you to look at his paper. It's very fun. So Einstein made the following argument. He said, let us consider a particle. And its energy will be E naught. We just have a particle sitting there. It's got some energy. And then after we have this particle and it has energy E1, okay, oops, but it's decayed into the original particle has emitted some radiation. Okay, so Einstein knew, following Marie Curie's work, that it's possible for particles to emit radiation. That was the basis of, that's what he's considering. I've got a particle before, and this particle decays into another particle, okay, still at rest, but it's emitted some radiation. And he's assuming it emits radiation with equal and opposite momentum. So the net momentum, finally, is zero. So this E1 can still be at rest. Okay, so it emits some radiation. And the radiation has energy L over 2. L is the, like, for luminosity. But it's actually the energy of the radiation. And that's it. So the principle Einstein's going to use is energy conservation. All right? He's going to say we had something here. It emitted some radiation. But I believe the total energy must be conserved. Okay? So you have to have energy conservation means that E naught is equal to E1 plus L over 2 plus L over 2. So that's his first basic formula. Seems totally reasonable. Okay? And now what Einstein's going to do is look at the same system, but in a moving frame. Okay? So now consider a moving frame. So in the moving frame, let's say that the moving frame is coming this way. Okay, so I've got some observer that's watching that particle, but this observer is moving along like this. Okay, well, in the moving frame, the velocity v let's see, in the along the x-axis. Okay, so actually I'm going to assume, let me see. Yeah, I'm going to assume that the in the moving frame, this particle is coming at me with velocity minus v. It won't actually matter what the sine of v is, but in the formula, I'm going to be moving this way and the particle will be coming towards me. Okay, so in the moving frame, what is the equation for energy conservation? So H naught, this will be the energy before. So he calls E the energy before. Sorry, he calls E the energy in the rest frame of the particle, H the energy in the moving frame. And before the emission, you have energy H naught. And after, you have energy H1. And here's the key ingredient. Einstein knows from Maxwell's theory that if I have some light traveling along, okay, in a wave packet, then if I move with respect to that wave packet, I can figure out what's the energy of the wave packet. That's all a consequence of Maxwell's theory. Okay, so he just quotes the result, and I'll derive the result next, but he just quotes the result. The result is 1/2 L. So if you have a wave of a packet of light, okay, and it's moving, let's say this one, right? It's moving along in that direction. And if I follow it with a velocity V, I can work out what is the energy of that packet of light. And the formula is this. So this was known, cosine phi, where phi is this angle, over root 1 minus v squared over c squared. That's the energy in this packet. And then he knew, then the energy in the other packet just has a plus sign here. Okay, so all this just came from Maxwell. Plus about 40 years of understanding Maxwell's equations. Okay, so all Einstein didn't have to do any work at all, right? So you just add those two terms together, and the V over C's cancel, and so this is equal to H1 plus L over root 1 minus V squared over C squared. The numerators, the cosine phi dependent term cancels. And so then you say, well, what does that mean? Well, it means that, so I have these two energy conservation equations, and now let's subtract them from each other. So H naught minus E naught. What is H naught minus E naught? So this is the energy in the frame where the particle is moving. That's the energy in the frame where it was at rest. Okay, what is the only thing this could be? It's an energy, right? It's the difference of two energies. And what could this be? What do you think it is? If I calculate the energy in a frame where it's at rest, and then I calculate in a frame where it's moving, what's the difference? Kinetic energy. Okay, so that is the kinetic energy of the particle before it decayed, right? Because that's what the naught meant. So I've got some particles, got some kinetic energy before it decays. And just using this equation, that's equal to H1 minus E1. And then the other two terms look like this. There's this extra term. So this is K0, the kinetic energy of the particle before it decayed. This is the kinetic energy of the particle after it decayed. And there's this excess. So what it's telling you is that K0 minus K1 is equal to L 1 over root 1 minus V squared over C squared minus 1. And that's approximately, if V over C is much less than 1, so the beauty of this argument is I can make it even if the velocity of the two frames is very small. Okay, so there's nothing really relativistic about this calculation. My second frame is moving very slowly. Okay, V can be much less than C. And this is L V squared over C squared over 2. So it's saying the difference in kinetic energy is some L over 2 C squared, sorry, L over C squared. So this is equal to 1 half L over C squared V squared. So the two things have different kinetic energy, and they're different by that quantity. Well, what is that? That's just that must be the difference in the mass. This is the kinetic energy. It must be half mv squared. And so this must be m. And so the mass of the particle changes by L over C squared due to the emission. The emission of energy E, energy L. Okay? So now in the rest of the lecture, we're just going to derive this formula. So this was an astonishing conclusion, right? That I have a particle at rest, emits light, and its mass changes. Just as a consequence of energy conservation. So how did he know those formulae for the energy of a packet of light? Okay, so Maxwell equations have a conserved energy. Okay, and this was known well before Einstein. The energy density, and let's call that rho, so that is the energy per unit volume in space, and that is equal to the familiar electrostatic formally, okay, so half E squared of epsilon naught, that's the energy in an electrostatic field, plus 1/2 B squared over mu naught, that's the energy in a magnetic field. And we also have an energy flux. So if I want to calculate how much energy leaves a region of space per unit time, I need to know this flux of energy. Do you know what that is given by? Does anyone know what the quantity is describing the flux of energy in electromagnetism? Pointing vector. Exactly. So the pointing vector, and we'll call it S. So that's pointing. The pointing vector is equal to 1 over mu naught E cross B. And then the statement that Maxwell has a conserved energy is just the statement that d rho by dt plus the divergence of S equals 0. And you can check that from the Maxwell equations, that the time derivative of rho is the divergence of S. And what this means is that if I pick some volume in space, and then if I define the energy in that volume to be the integral d3x over that volume times rho, then of course the rate of change of the energy is equal to integral from this equation minus the integral d3x div s. And then by the divergence theorem, this is equal to minus integral s dot the normal vector ds over the area. So this has some area, some surface. It has a normal vector, and it has an area element ds. And what this is saying is the rate of change of energy in the volume is the negative of the energy flux out of the surface. Okay? So if you can find some quantities like this that obey an equation like that, that's a continuity equation, then you have a conserved energy. Okay, so people knew this was the energy in the electromagnetic field. And so now all we have to do is compute the energy in a wave packet of light. And then we're going to see how that energy transforms in different frames. And all that's done just using Maxwell's equations. Okay, so let's consider a wave packet. And for simplicity, remember we're considering this particle which decays into two packets of radiation. For simplicity, I'm just going to stick them along the x-axis. Okay, to forget about that cos phi angle, didn't really matter anyway. So let me think about that. Yeah, pick phi to be 0. Okay, so I'm going to pick phi equals 0. Because I just don't want to bother with keeping the angles around and doing Lorentz transformation. I'm just going to work in x and t. You can easily generalize that. But just to keep it short, I'm going to pick phi equals 0. Einstein's argument is still fine with phi equals 0. So we've got some wave packet moving along the x-axis. Okay, so let's picture it. Actually, here's the x-axis, and I'm going to choose the wave packet of light so that we only have the electric field in the z direction. Okay, so x, y, z, I'm going to have a wave of light with a packet in which the z component of the electric field is non-zero. Okay, that's all. And no y component. Because again, I just need to do one example. So the electric field will be 0, 0, Ez. And Ez will be a function of x minus ct. Any function of x minus ct. And it actually won't matter what the function is. So we've already seen that solves Maxwell's equations. And it's a linearly polarized light wave moving along the x axis. Now, the magnetic field is going to be 0 by 0. And from Maxwell's equations, we've got curl E equals minus dB dt. This curl E, I've got to differentiate this. The only non-zero derivative is the x derivative. So dx Ez is the only component. And that'll come up in the y direction. So this is some vector that is minus Ez prime, 0. The prime means differentiate with respect to x. Okay, so I take this formula. D by dx will give me whatever this function is. I'm getting its derivative here. On the right-hand side, I've got the time derivative of the magnetic field. And so that is going to give me 0. B is in the y direction. So that's going to give me C by prime 0. Okay, so one minus sign from here. And then d by dt of this function, so the by is by of x minus ct as well. Take the time derivative of that, I'll get a minus c factor times by prime. And so from this, you can see that by is equal to minus Ez over c up to a constant, which we'll ignore. A constant magnetic field is always just a solution of Maxwell's equations, but we're not interested in it. We're just interested in the propagating part of the solution. OK, so we have this formula. So that's what an electromagnetic wave is. And now if we want to compute the energy in it, we're basically going to have to compute the point, the energy carried by the wave. We're going to use the Poynting vector. But first of all, we've got to go to the moving frame. Okay, here's my light wave going along the x-axis. All right, I want to run after it, and I want to compute what's the light wave in the moving frame. Okay. So to do that, I use a Lorentz transformation. So what is the light wave in the moving frame? Okay. So my moving frame is going to be the observer moving along with some velocity v in the x direction, chasing after this wave. So we use a Lorentz transformation. We need to calculate f prime alpha beta, which is lambda lambda f. Let's see, am I doing with upstairs or downstairs? I'm going to do it with upstairs. And so this is easy to do, just a bit of matrix algebra. My lambda matrix here is gamma minus gamma v over c minus gamma v over c, gamma 1, 1. And then I'll have my F matrix. So you see, if you put the indices in here, F alpha beta, you can see that I have, mu nu. This is equal to lambda F lambda transpose. And so let's put in our field strength here. Now, the only non-zero components were Ez. So that's Ez over C. Of course, minus Ez over C. And then we had a By. Minus By. And zeros everywhere else. This minus By must be here, plus By. There, there, there. And then I put my Lorentz transformation over here again, gamma minus gamma V over C minus gamma V over C gamma 1, 1. Do the algebra, and you will find that Ez prime is gamma Ez plus V By, and By prime is equal to gamma By plus V over C, Ez over C. Okay, so that's where, you know, when you do the Lorentz transformation properties of the electromagnetic field, they're kind of messy. Well, they're just messy because they're two lambdas. Okay, so that's where the Lorentz transformation comes from. And so this is the electric field seen by the moving observer and magnetic field. But we already have this formula that By was minus Ez over C. Okay? So we had By is minus Ez over C. And so if I put that together, then, in fact, I have that this is square root of 1 minus V over C, 1 plus V over C, By, and the, Ez, and this is equal to the same factor, By. Okay, so the only thing that happens when you chase after an electromagnetic wave is that the amplitude of the wave changes by this factor. Do you know what that factor is called? Doppler effect. That's the relativistic Doppler effect. Okay, so the amplitude of the electric field changes. Now, there's something a little bit more subtle, which is you must realize that the Lorentz transformation, what does the Lorentz transformation mean? It means that Ez prime of x prime minus ct prime, this is some function of x prime minus ct prime, right, on the left-hand side, is equal to gamma Ez of x minus ct plus v by of x minus ct. Okay, so the point is, when you do a Lorentz transformation, you don't just transform the field, you transform its argument as well. That's what the electric field is in these coordinates. You've got to transform the function and the coordinates. Okay? But, in fact, x minus ct... Okay, so we've done this part of the algebra. Okay, we've got the gammas and the v's. Now we need to know what is x minus ct in terms of x prime and ct prime. So let's work that out. X minus ct is, of course, gamma x prime plus vt prime. So what am I doing here? I'm using the inverse Lorentz transform to go from x to x prime and t prime. Okay, because x prime is gamma x minus vt. So x is gamma x prime plus vt prime. I just use the inverse. And the inverse you get just by flipping the sign of v. Okay, so but, and then we've got the t part of it, minus c, gamma t prime plus v x prime over c squared. And so this is equal to gamma times 1 minus v over c times x prime minus ct prime. And so that is also given by this Doppler factor. You see, gamma is 1 over root 1 minus v squared over c squared. That's equal to 1 over square root 1 minus v over c, 1 plus v over c. And so if I have this factor in the numerator, then this whole combination is 1 minus v over c over 1 plus v over c times x prime minus ct prime. Okay, so I've got these outside factors, the gamma and the gamma v, but then also the argument of this function has to change, has to be re-expressed in terms of x prime and ct prime. And then I actually know what this quantity is. Okay? So now we have the electric and magnetic fields in the moving frame. And so now we can calculate the pointing vector. And that will give us the energy flux. So the pointing is E cross B. So I take the EZ and the BY. And their cross product will give me the flux in the x direction. And so the pointing is 1 minus v over c over 1 plus v over c. So this is in t prime x prime coordinates. The pointing is this. I got this from the essentially this factor in the E and the B fields. And then I have Ez squared over c, 1 over mu naught. That came from the definition of the pointing vector. Actually, let me write it this way. 1 over mu naught, Ez squared over c. And the argument now is the argument here is root 1 minus v over c over 1 plus v over c, x prime minus ct prime. And what this means is that's the original function. Whatever pulse shape I had before is this function Ez of its argument, and this is the argument in the x and x prime t prime coordinates. So, finally, we need the energy. So, to do this, we've got our pulse traveling along in the x direction. And I want to calculate how much energy does that pulse carry. So, what I do is I sit at fixed x and I watch the pulse go past. Okay? So, the total energy is the integral equals the integral of the dt of the pointing flux. Okay, it's really an energy per unit area, but at the moment we're just doing this in the x direction. So I've got this pointing flux coming along, and it'll travel through the surface at fixed x. So I just have to take the pointing flux and integrate it dt, and it'll give me the energy and the pulse. And basically, when you do that integral dt prime, I'm integrating this function. Its argument has this funny factor in it. So I need to change variable. I'm working at fixed x prime, say x prime equals 0. So just do this integral and change variables to this being the new the new coordinate. So let's call it ct prime twiddle. The whole thing at x equals 0, x prime equals 0. And do this integral, and basically you'll get the inverse of this factor. Okay? And so now we will get that the energy of the wave packet equals the energy in the original frame times, first of all, this factor, and then this factor from doing the time integral. And so the result is I just get one factor of the Doppler shift, square root. And that's the formula Einstein used. Okay? So as you can see, it's a kind of messy calculation, and you really need to know what you're doing. Okay? But Einstein didn't know what he was doing. And once you know that in Maxwell's theory, if I run after a wave, its energy decreases in this way. So the formula I gave you was actually 1 minus v over c cos phi over square root 1 minus v squared over c squared, right? But then I'm only doing it for phi equals 0. So that's equal to this, and that's equal to that. Okay? I should have a square in here. Sorry, no, I shouldn't. Sorry. I shouldn't. Sorry. Yeah. Okay, are there any questions? Yeah.
Is that how they would have originally derived that?
Mm-hmm.
Really?
Absolutely. 19th century, they were pretty masterful. I don't know when Poynting invented the Poynting flux, but I assume it was 1880 or 1890.
I was just wondering about using all the Lorentz transformations.
Well, that's what Lorentz figured out. So Lorentz figured out that these equations have this symmetry. And that alone is enough to tell you that if I'm moving, what does the light wave look like? Because when you do the symmetry, it's exactly what you're doing. You're doing a symmetry which takes someone who's static, and in the new coordinates, you're moving. And then you do these operations on the light wave. They're moving the light wave to the frame in which the observer is moving. So Lorentz understood all that. And, you know, unfortunately, Einstein doesn't give any references, so you've no idea where he got this formula, okay, this one with the cos phi. But I think it must have been common knowledge among a certain very elite group of people that that was the right formula for the energy of a wave packet. But, you know, as you can see, it's an amazingly economical argument. Just want to say one more thing, which is that there's a... You see, once you realize relativity is correct, and at the same time, you know, what else did Einstein do in 1905? What? Yeah, he did that, and one other thing. Three big papers. What? Photoelectric. So quantum mechanics, okay? So relativity and quantum mechanics in the same year. And actually, you can see, now people always moan about relativity and quantum mechanics don't go together. Okay, that's what the goal of PI, I told you last year, last lecture, the goal of PI is to reconcile these things. But in fact, when you think about particles, they go together beautifully. Okay, from the point of view of particles, relativity and quantum mechanics go beautifully. And let me just show you that, because you can derive this formula with the cos phi in two lines if you realize that light is quantized. Okay? So this is why Einstein could do both of these things. He was actually kind of cheating, because he had a clue from quantum mechanics already. So he could actually derive that very nasty formula from Maxwell's equations in one, let me see, I've got it here somewhere, in two lines. Okay, so what do you need to know to get that formula? Only thing you need to know is that the energy of a photon is h nu, where nu is a frequency. Okay, that was the formula Planck guessed and Einstein confirmed in his theory of the photoelectric effect. So I've got this pulse of electromagnetic light, but let's not think about it that way. Think about it as a photon, right? A particle of light. And now let's do this relativity with this particle of light. Okay, and now this transformation of the energy, remember we had energy L over 2, and then it went to L over 2, and then in the rest frame of the particle, and then that went to L over 2, 1 minus V over C cos, what was the formula? Yeah, 1 minus V over C cos phi over root 1 minus V squared over C squared. Okay, in the moving frame. So what I'll show you is that if you understand this formula, then that is totally obvious. Okay, and that's the which is the it's called it has a name that formula. It's the relativistic Doppler effect or something like that. Anyway, so I'll show you why it's obvious. Let's take the moving observer. Okay, moving observer, so we have our particle decaying into light, L over 2 and L over 2, or emitting these two photons. The moving observer has a four velocity, okay, which is dt d tau, right, a dc dt d tau. Okay, which is just gamma in the first component, right? Remember we had c dt d tau, but d tau was the square root, I hope I get the c's right, d tau was the, d tau was equal to, yeah, so it's c dt over c dt root 1 minus v squared over c squared. And so this is just gamma. Okay, so the zero component of the four velocity is just gamma, the Lorentz factor. And then the space components are just gamma v over c. Again, by dimensions, because they've got to have no dimensions. What is the four momentum of the photon? Well, that is some quantity which has it's got to be null because the photon is null, and if we know its energy or equivalently the momentum, we can just if we know its momentum, let's call it L over 2, the momentum, 1 cos phi sine phi. Okay, so why did I write that down? Because the magnitude of the momentum is L over 2. In fact, I need to know it's really L over 2c. So again, what you know from pointing, from Maxwell's theory is that if a wave has a certain energy, it will carry a certain momentum, which is L over 2c. It's moving in this this direction. Okay, so I've just drawn this vector. I've given this vector in the spatial coordinates, which is cos phi sine phi. Its length is L over 2c. It's null, so this component must be 1. Okay, so that the square of this gives me minus 1 plus cos squared plus sine squared. And then you say, then it's easy, because you just say, what is the energy energy of the photon? You see, so I've worked these things out in the rest frame. Right, that's the four velocity of the observer, and that's the, in fact, let me just write this out here, because the observer was going in the x direction.
Okay. Why is the four momentum and the three
components? Good point. It's a zero here. Okay? This was x, and this was y. I should have really called that z, I suppose, but I've just done it in the xy plane. So I've worked out these four vectors in the frame where the particle is static. Okay. Now, how do I work out the energy of the photon as seen in the rest frame of this particle of the observer? Well, that's easy because all I do in the rest frame of the observer. That, I claim, is equal to minus P mu U mu. Now, why is that true? It's because P, in the rest frame of the observer, U mu is 1, 0, 0. Okay? Sorry. This is a Lorentz invariant quantity. Okay, so if I work it out in the Lorentz frame of the observer, the U mu only has a zero component. This only has a zero component. So this will give me P0 equals P0 in the, and I guess I should have a C. Yeah. Okay, so just take the dot product of this vector and that vector, and you will get gamma L over 2 times 1 minus P over C cos phi. And that's the formula Einstein used. Okay, so knowing that the energy is H nu actually allows you to get this formula very, very simply. Okay, are there any other questions? Yeah?
So, when Lorentz read as transform, do you get it from the Michelson-Morley experiment?
Sorry, when Lorentz did?
Do you get it from the Michelson-Morley experiment, looking at the triangles, or do you just, like,
Maxwell's equation? Just Maxwell's equation. Yep. You didn't need to know. In fact, Michelson-Morley is in fact irrelevant to the history of the whole story. It was important psychologically, but didn't really play any role at all. In fact, there's an amazing history of this, and if you look at the, there's a phenomenon called aberration of starlight. Okay. Which was known in the 17th century. And somebody, the Astronomer Royal in Britain, was called James Bradley. And he measured this. And basically the phenomenon is that as the Earth goes around the solar system, you see the angle subtended by a star wobbling backwards and forwards. It's like the analogy is with rain. When you walk in through rain, and it's going vertically, and if you walk with respect to this vertical rain, the rain is kind of coming towards you, so you need to point your umbrella that way. And so it's the same with the telescope. You want to see the star, you actually have to point it, and you're moving, you have to point it in the direction you're moving. It's a little bit counterintuitive. But this was known about in the 17th century, and this guy Bradley actually worked out the formula for the angle you move in terms of V and the speed of light. And in 1727, he measured the speed of light using this effect as 186,000 miles an hour. Okay? Now, the Bradley explanation of the aberration of starlight is relativistic. You look it up on Wikipedia. It's very funny because they try to derive this formula, and they use relativity to derive it. So this was actually known. I mean, the guy had a relativistic derivation of the aberration in 1727. no one really tried to reconcile this with mechanics, and light was always a bit mysterious, and so they, you know, it just was forgotten about. So astronomers knew it, but And they knew what speed of light was, and this is exactly how it was measured. It was measured through a relativistic effect. Okay. And then Maxwell came along. So the whole story of Michelson-Morley is just a total red herring. Though it was necessary psychologically to show that there was nothing wrong with light moving at the same speed in all frames. But yeah, no real information was gained from it. So, as I emphasize, and we may see this when we get to cosmology, you may see it in the second course, but when you put quantum theory together with relativity, and you're talking about particles, it actually works beautifully. There's no inconsistency. There's, it's only when you get a bit messier. So say you do quantum field theory. Now, quantum field theory combines relativity and quantum mechanics, and the first thing it does is give you infinity. And then you have to do it renormalization and get rid of all those infinities, big mess, okay? And similarly, when you go to gravity, you're, again, combining quantum mechanics with relativity in a field theory. General relativity is a field theory. And again, you get disasters, you get infinities and so on. But at the level of particles, there's no incompatibility. Quite the contrary. The theory fits together like a glove. Quantum mechanics and relativity of particles is absolutely beautiful. And that's essentially why there's a belief that the S matrix, okay, what is an S matrix? S matrix is a mapping from an incoming set of particles to an outgoing set of particles. The S matrix should be absolutely fine in quantum theories of space-time. Okay, it's when you start looking in the middle. What happened in the scattering? You have to think about, you're not thinking about particles anymore. You've got this very messy configuration of fields and all that. Then you get all the disasters. So what we're looking for probably isn't a theory which is local. It's a theory of particles, which tells you how an incoming state of relativistic particles goes to an outgoing state. And as I say, there's really no incompatibility between relativity and quantum mechanics when you only talk about particles. In fact, you probably, just as an example, do you know what happens to light as the universe expands? Does anybody know? So a photon traveling through space, and the universe is, of course, expanding. What happens to the light?
The wavelength increases.
Wavelength increases. It stretches. Okay. And this is a very easy way to understand the fact that when we let me just get this right. This is how we measure the redshift. Well, this is why redshift allows you to measure distance in the universe. So when I look out and I see a star and its spectral lines are not where they would be on Earth, they're all stretched to the red. All the wavelengths have gone redwards. The reason is that it emitted some light, and the light traveled all the way to us, but as it was traveling, space was expanding and stretching out its wavelength. Okay. So how do we see that? Well, to think about it quantum mechanically, it's very obvious. I say quantum mechanically, either a particle or light, as it's traveling through the universe, its wavelength, quantum mechanically they have a wavelength. Okay, so light obviously has a wavelength. A particle like a massive particle in quantum mechanics still has a wavelength, the de Broglie wavelength. These wavelengths are stretched by the expansion of the universe. And that's correct. That picture is completely correct. So if you want to understand how does the momentum of a particle change in an expanding universe, go to the quantum picture, where it has a de Broglie wavelength, watch the wavelength expand, the momentum decreases, and then come back to the picture of momentum. And that gives exactly the right answer. Again, it's another illustration that quantum mechanics and relativity really go very, very well together. And often you can use quantum mechanics to do shortcut arguments where the actual classical calculation is a real pain. Quantum mechanics sort of tells you the answer straight away, as it did here. knowing that energy is quantized is often a shortcut. Okay. Any other questions or ideas? So I guess your class is at 3:30?
Yeah. So the tutorials will start at 2 o'clock. We will start